Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 17, Heroes and Hope. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. I want to welcome you to the special edition of the Freedom Writers Podcast. We'll be sharing a live recording of a panel I had the privilege of curating with five survivors of genocide. It's a little different format from our traditional show, but this discussion was of such gravity and magnitude that we wanted you to hear it just as our audience first experienced it. In honor of National Teacher Appreciation Day in May of 2015, the Freedom Writers Foundation hosted a symposium in Washington, D.C., with freedom writers and freedom writer teachers from all around the world. We hosted workshops, panels, and keynote speakers to spark discussion and inspire our teachers to take bold action. One of the highlights of the symposium was this panel of genocide survivors. Our esteemed guests on the panel are true heroes, heroes whose voices you may already know or be familiar with. All of them have played a critical role in the Freedom Writers story, and nearly all of them have joined us on this podcast before. These guests include Renee Firestone, Andrew Carroll, Zlata Filipovic, Bunny Seck, and Gare Dewaney. New to some of you will be our panelist Trezor Rusesabagina, who hails from Rwanda. I'll introduce Trezor and the rest of the panel in just a moment, but first, I want to talk about the context behind their discussion. The subject of genocide awareness has played a pivotal role in my students' education since the very beginning. By learning about the Holocaust, the Cambodian and Bosnian genocides, and other atrocities, the Freedom Writers were able to make sense of the violence in their own lives. Relating to stories from other young people who had experienced hardships helped the Freedom Writers find their own voices and share their stories with the world. Today, as part of our mission to provide tools to educators to empower all students to succeed, the Freedom Writers Foundation emphasizes awareness and activism on these issues. We believe in empathetic and compassionate education for all students, no matter their color or creed. And we believe the best way to accomplish that is by illuminating heroes like those on this panel. It is a privilege to introduce to you our panelists from this event. First, we have our dear, beloved Renee Firestone, who is a Holocaust survivor.
While we were in the camp, which was for me more than a year in Auschwitz, the daily food was a slice of bread in the afternoon. I remember we had to put out our hands like this, and they slapped a spoonful of sugar beets in it. Or on the Sundays, they gave us a slice of salami with that slice of bread. Now that was our daily intake for a year.
Renee was living in Czechoslovakia when the war broke out. When she was 20 years old, she and her family were captured by the Nazis and sent to Auschwitz in a cattle car. She lost her mother in a gas chamber and her sister from medical experimentation, only to lose her father shortly after liberation. You can listen to her full story in our first podcast episode, Lest We Forget. Next, we have Zlata Filipovic, the author of the best-selling book, Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo.
There was this day that I'll never forget, and there was a tank in front of my house, and the post office opposite my house, it was in flames, and our telephone lines were cut, and we sat in this dark, smelly cellar for 10 hours, 12 hours, just listening to explosions and pounding outside, and this is when we knew, okay, this is really real, this is really serious, and from there on, danger was in every moment.
Zlata survived the Bosnian genocide as a young girl growing up in Sarajevo. She watched as labels and stereotypes drove her neighbors and her nation to extreme violence, and the country she called home began to fall apart. After her diary of the war was published in 1993, she was soon hailed as the modern-day Anne Frank. You can hear my full conversation with Zlata in Episode 5, The Pencil of War. Next on our panel, you'll hear from Trésor Rusesabagina from the country of Rwanda.
In 1994, a Hutu rebel group wanted to kill all the Tutsis of Rwanda. The genocide was just an attempt at eradicating a whole ethnic group. It wasn't organized. It was, if you were a Tutsi and you got out of the house, you were gonna be killed. It was usually a slow death. It was usually machetes to chop off a tall tree, they called it.
Trésor was just 2 years old when the genocide in Rwanda broke out. His father, Paul, was a hotel manager in Kigali and courageously was instrumental in rescuing over 1,000 lives. You may have seen their harrowing story as depicted in the Oscar-nominated film, Hotel Rwanda. Bunny Sek is an original freedom writer and the daughter of two survivors from the Cambodian genocide.
The stories I hear of my parents telling me about bombs being dropped and hordes of people just trying to escape and nobody knows really where they're going. A lot of confusion, a lot of sadness, and just survival. Navigating through landmines and dodging bullets and hiding at night and the sheer amount of people who have suffered so much, I can't even wrap my head around.
Bunny was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and grew up in Long Beach, California. When she was young, her parents tried to shield her from what they had experienced at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. But since her father's passing, Bunny has started piecing together parts of their story and now uses her platform as a freedom writer to advocate for refugees and immigrants. Our final panelist is Gare Duwany, one of the Lost Boys of Sudan.
By the time that I was introduced into being a refugee in 1986, where we had to walk hundreds of miles to go to Ethiopia, I was pretty aware that something is happening in a country because I already witnessed the killing and being caught in a crossfire, you know, because I have seen the helicopters dropping bombs over us, and I have seen them coming to our villages, raiding villages, and they then being resisted by freedom fighters.
When the civil war in Sudan broke out, Gare was only 7 years old. He and his family fled the conflict, trekking across the desert to a refugee camp in Ethiopia. They witnessed death and destruction in every step of that journey. You can hear Gare's full story with an introduction from Bunny on episode 15 in The Crossroads of Countries. I had the honor of co-moderating this panel alongside the ever-inspiring Andrew Carroll, an author, activist, and historian whose work collecting war letters has taken him across countries and continents into conflicts both past and present. The stories he preserves continue to raise awareness and instill hope, and this panel is surely an extension of Andrew's life's mission. You can hear more from Andrew in Episode 4, The Humanity in History. I'm eager for you to listen to these heroes and hope that you too are moved by their stories. Here it is, our feature discussion, recorded live in Washington, D.C. It is a great honor and so humbling to turn the microphone over to these amazing people. We get a window into their soul and the hope that we can learn lessons from our past so we're not doomed to repeat it. And I hope we can walk away feeling like we can continue to tell their story to anyone and everyone who will listen. Without further ado, Andrew Carroll.
Thank you all so much. The privilege is mine to be in the company of you all and these incredible people, true heroes. I want to get to the heart of the matter. I want this to be as beneficial to you all as possible as educators. I would presume that one of the great challenges you have is how do you teach something that is so enormous that the numbers are almost overwhelming and almost abstract and so large. During World War II, 6 million Jews killed over a six-year period. That's about 3,000 people on average a day, or a 9/11 every single day for 6 years. In Rwanda, you have 800,000 people killed in a matter of 3.5 months. In Srebrenica, 8,000 men and boys killed in 48 hours. In the Sudan and Darfur, you have hundreds of thousands of people killed in a war that's still going on. Cambodia, 1.7 million people from 1975 through 1979, a fifth of the country wiped out. This leads to my first question for our panelists. When you talk with students or any audience, is there one particular story that makes these numbers real? So it's not some abstract concept, but something that has stayed with you that was particularly chilling, powerful, and that made these genocides real and not just statistics.
First of all, when the war ended, we had no idea how many people actually were murdered in the Holocaust. But when we found out the number, this was unimaginable. I mean, you can't address it, you can't understand it. And when I realized what really happened, and now I'm free, my first thought was, who were these people? Who were these people that murdered people who they knew nothing about, didn't know what kind of people they were? Were they good people, bad people? This is something that, to me, is totally unimaginable even today. And how could it happen after the Holocaust that other countries and other people did the same thing? And when I went to Rwanda and I heard that within 4 months, almost 1 million people were murdered, how can you address it? How can you answer that kind of question?
I'm very, very humbled to be here. I was an infant, and you know what? I thank God every day that I was what I was, that I don't have those memories. So I think of myself as a bridge. I grew up under stories and stories and stories. So one of the stories that I'm going to tell you in order to make it a human experience for people, and that I tell the audience when I talk about Rwanda and the genocide, is a story that my dad told me. So in the movie, Hotel Rwanda, there's one part that I see my dad going up the roof to look for us. He was looking up the roof because he thought we had jumped. He thought we committed suicide, and it wasn't us. So I asked my dad, I was like, is this, did people really do this kind of stuff? Like, he told me they did. People did go up roofs, and people did jump, and they took their families with them, because if they didn't, then they died by meeting machete. That touched me, because I love my family more than anything in the world. And when he told me that, I could kind of grasp the situation. And so that's the story that I tell, because many people don't understand how crazy it was.
I just want to give Zlata a chance to say something, to share your experiences, your stories as well.
Thank you very much. One of the things that I think that I found, because my diary was published, and when I started writing my diary and I was writing about my childhood before the war, which really consisted of all these different things that were never going to be any significant to anyone but me in 20, 30 years time. What I found is that for people who read the diary and they could connect with the peacetime part of me, they could also connect with the war part of me, which was a sort of a foreign thing to people. You know, what does it mean to be living in a city where you get 900 bombs that fall in one day? I mean, 900 times hearing an explosion, hearing something whiz over your house, hoping that it's not going to hit your house. But why did people connect with my diary? They connected because I wrote about birthday parties and because I wrote about my best friend. They connected because I wrote about my grandmother. And I think ultimately we all connect to those little moments of humanity.
Bunny, I'd like to start with, you lost your father and you lost a connection to your past. Your father witnessed all of this as he was protecting the family and protecting your innocence. So let's start there and paying homage to your dad, who actually truly experienced the Khmer Rouge and this genocide.
1 million, 2 million, 6 million, that's a huge number. And it's hard to really take in what that means. But I want to ask everybody in the audience to raise their hand if they've lost somebody they've loved. Now multiply that by two as if they've just died again and again and again and again. And my journey until this point in my life, I didn't understand until my dad passed away 2 years ago. And he made me understand what loss really was. And the grief and the pain and the horror. And when he tells me the story of his loss, that multiplied it for me even deeper. The intensity just kept digging deeper and deeper into my soul as I learned stories upon stories that came out after his death because they were kept hidden from me to protect me and my family. So if you can imagine the person you love and the person that they've loved and intensify that feeling a million times over, then you can truly understand what war is like. All I can do is speak from my experience of how I've felt that extreme loss in my personal life with a true understanding of comprehending that enormity.
I thank my father for that. When you hear the word genocide, what does that mean to you?
To me, genocide means senseless violence. Really, all violence is senseless to me. People are subjected to something that nobody should be subjected to. And we come into this world just wanting to live our lives, to have experience, to love. And I think ultimately that's everybody's goal, is to learn to love. And genocide takes all of that away. And I see the suffering and the pain from genocide, and it carries on generationally. I didn't suffer myself in the hands of, obviously, that genocide. However, I was a product of it. And seeing my parents go through the process of experiencing their babies being killed and their families being killed, I suffer with people who have suffered in the hands of loss on that scale.
Here, do you want to address this? Thanks, everybody. I'm really delighted to be around such a courageous people. In my case, I was born in Sudan, and so many things happen in our country where putting the numbers into this type of battles is very difficult for me because I've been through a lot of battles myself. And seeing a country that is over 40 million people, we lost about 3 million people. My mom has 10 of us. And right now, it's only 5 of us that are still alive. 5 has died. I talk to a lot of students, and then there's something that we all share, and that something is a pain. We all come from different backgrounds, and we all in this world all together. When we pinch each other, we can feel the pain the same way. When we describe the pain, we can describe it in many different ways, because that's how we feel inside. So pain connects us. So I'm always connecting with kids, because people connected with me when I was a small boy. Our civil war broke out when I was only 7 years old. So if I can experience something like that, I like them to learn about what happened to me, because that can happen to them too at some point. And then it would be good for all of us to be aware, to keep our kids informed. It's very important to me.
This may sound like an obvious question, but just doing the math on when these genocides took place, even with Rwanda and Bosnia, most high school students and college students today were not even alive when those happen, as much as they seem like, you know, recent events for those of us who are older. When a young student says to you, why should I really care about this? This has nothing to do with my life. Slada, do you want to take on this question of when, you know, people ask you what is the importance, what's the relevance of their own lives? How do you respond to that?
There's a number of different things. I mean, one is any knowledge is power, any understanding of anything. And these are things that happen, unfortunately, as you can see by everybody who's seated in the panel, and these things repeat themselves. And how do we learn them, and how do we understand them, and how do we learn and understand them so we can prevent them, so we can resolve them, so we can stop them from taking place again? So that would be something that I would feel very strongly passionate about. But I also think it's important to honor the memory of all those that have perished as a result of these atrocities, the memory of those who've perished, the experiences of those who survived this. So there's kind of two things that I feel very strongly about, is to honor people who've experienced it and who might have perished, and to learn so we can learn for ourselves and we can learn for future, because these things are made by us, by humans, and they can happen anywhere. And how do we learn how to not make these mistakes again?
Trezor?
When you say high school kids weren't alive during the Rwandan genocide, that is true. But, you know, to them, I'd say, look at Syria, look at Boko Haram, look at Nigeria. These are things that are going on today, you know? So I'd, first of all, turn their attention to that. And like Zlata said, knowledge is power. It is, absolutely. But here's the thing. When you know something and you don't do something about it, that's even worse. When I was given the opportunity to talk about genocide, I really didn't want to do that. I was one of those kids. It was just my first couple years of college. I was pretty much a high school student, so I really didn't want to go up there and talk about genocide. But then I started thinking, I'm not saying anything. Do you know how much worse that is when I have the opportunity to teach you about this? That's pretty much killing myself, killing my people.
Thank you. And Renee, you've talked to thousands upon thousands of students. What do you try and convey to them about why it's important that they see that this is relevant to their own lives when they're thinking, this could never happen here. This is not Nazi Germany. Why do we have to study these things? What's your sense when you talk to them about that?
When I was a child, I grew up in a different world than they did. I grew up in Czechoslovakia, and we never even heard of the Armenian genocide. So how could we even imagine something like that happening? Today, you teach about not one genocide, but many genocides. So today, we expect from the population to understand that. You know, Turkey never even admitted, even today, that there was a genocide. So we never heard about genocides. What's a genocide? We didn't even know. And when Hitler started his campaign against the Jews, the Jewish people didn't have a country. So who would expect somebody to invade a people that doesn't have a country? You know, wars between countries, not between people. And then to find out that individual people have this hatred and take guns and are willing to kill another people was unheard of, unimaginable. So, of course, today, when we know, we already know what happened to all these people. Of course, we expect all these people and all the world to fight against such things. But they don't. You don't find people who stop them. I'm talking about governments, because we must admit that there are some individuals who were helping throughout all these genocides. But those are individuals. And that's why I admire the teachers that are willing to join this group and are willing to learn about it. And I hope that they will someday change the world, because the world needs changing.
I want to talk about something that's probably a little tender. Can you help us put a face to what it means to be a refugee, to seek asylum? Help teachers see the face, see the name, all of those things when they have students come into their class. What do you, as the refugee, as a person who needs peace and a dream, what did you need, and what do these kids need?
For me personally, it was just needing to feel like I belonged. You know, when I was rushed into school, I didn't know English other than maybe there was a television and I was watching a cartoon, but learning the language was very difficult. Learning the culture was difficult. Being scared, not knowing how to behave. I don't know how many times I've peed my pants because I didn't raise my hand to ask the teacher to go use the restroom, and having to change pants, and that moment being embarrassing for me growing up. So those were just some of the things, and I just asked teachers to really reach out to students, because we don't make the connection. I truly didn't know anything. It's definitely a process, and I think most importantly is just being able to look at that child and reach out and make sure that, you know, whatever needs that they can take care of. It's really basic, actually, and just making sure we get to the restroom okay, making sure we're fed, and a lot of times that is just enough, and maybe a a hug every so often.
Trezor?
Being a teacher, I quickly learned that it was one of those jobs that, you know, you don't always hear the thank you at the end of the day, and you don't always, you know, get the salary you wish for, or, you know. But the teachers that I've gotten to meet, at least with the Freedom Riders, man, they love their kids. Like, it's like they live for their kids. They love their kids. I feel like growing up, I was with my teachers probably more than I was with my parents. So it's kind of like, I'm not saying you're their parent, but you do help mold these people. And if you didn't have a selfless attitude, I don't know that you'd be doing this job. You know, I don't think you'd even like it, you know. And the fact that you're here, I mean, y'all are my inspiration. You're the reason why I do this. We do this because we have a world to build. We have a future to take care of. And I think that's amazing.
Years ago, Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the president of France, instituted a policy in the schools where every French fifth grader would get the identity of a real French child who was killed by the Nazis or the Vichy government. And there was a huge backlash to this. A lot of people thought it was too disturbing for young children, really for any grade school students. And he met a lot of opposition. Do you all feel that in educating people about genocide, there almost needs to be a bit of a shock factor, or can that be counterproductive or gratuitous? And let's, you know, start again if you want to address this, Gare.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very important. All of us in this room was kids at some point. So I think that's why it's important, you know, for teachers such as you guys, we really share these stories with those students. That way they will grow knowing that they are responsible as well. When you're young, you don't really know that, but the older you get and then you understand, responsibility is for all of us, even the small kids. And I think you guys are really doing a wonderful job. That's the reason I couldn't hesitate to be here with such a wonderful people that are really changing the world like you guys.
Salad, I don't know, what's your feeling on the responsibility of a teacher to convey things that might be truly horrifying? Is that part of what they have to do, or can it be counterproductive?
I always feel maybe I'm being too harsh when I'm answering this, but I'll say it anyway. I think, you know, protecting from learning whilst young people of the same age somewhere else in the world are experiencing this. So we're scared of telling stories that might be upsetting, whilst at the same time, the reality of this upset is happening to infants and two-year-olds and six-year-olds and 12-year-olds, etc. So I don't know whether I'm being too hard, but I just feel like let's not protect from stories. Let's first of all try and protect from this happening to some other children. This is the reality. This is the reality for their contemporaries. So I kind of feel that we should be able to tell the stories as they are. Of course, moderating them age appropriately. But I think, why not?
Thank you. Trezor?
First of all, what Zlata said is absolutely true. I mean, we think we're scaring kids in America when we tell these stories. These are just words. Kids other places are living these things. So that was just to reiterate what she said, because I thought it was so important. Also, the shock value, yeah, I think it is important, because what happens when you're shocked, you feel something. Just like when you're scared, you feel something. And when you feel something, only then you want to act, you know, you want to do something. What happens when you watch a movie, when you read an intense book, you want to get up and take action, you know, you want to rise up for the people, whatever you want to do, you want to do something. So yeah, you need that shock factor. I mean, you guys ever heard of the saying, never again? And what happens afterwards? It happens again. I don't want that to happen again. So yes, I will shock them and I will scare them.
I agree that it's absolutely necessary to have people feel the compassion by feeling the pain and the horror that happened. And the only way you can open up people to that kind of vulnerability is to be honest. And you can't keep protecting people from what is the truth. And how many of us don't watch a certain movie or don't read a certain book because we don't want to be hurt? But that doesn't help anybody to make any kind of change. And I've done that in my life. And the only way to really be out there, be proactive, make those changes, and to make things happen is if you allow yourself to feel what that other person is feeling. And that has to be raw, it has to be real, it has to be authentic, and that's just what I believe.
Renee, you survived Auschwitz. When you talk to students about that experience, do you find yourself holding back telling certain stories, or do you tell them the true horror of it?
Yes, I do tell the whole story and the whole horror, but I also talk about Les Chambons, a French community which saved a lot of Jews. This whole community took in, I don't remember exactly how many young children, kept them, and because the Nazis knew that the whole community is holding them and supporting them, they did nothing to them. They knew that Les Chambons has these Jewish people, and nevertheless didn't threaten them, because they knew that, you know, a whole group of people who wants to help react differently than an individual. And that's what we also have to talk about. We have to talk about those who risked their lives, who were willing to help. And if many of them would have been, how many would have been saved? So, you know, yes, you have to tell both stories.
Stephen Hawking recently gave an interview where he said that he doesn't think that humanity is going to last another 1,000 years. He thinks that we're pretty much going to wipe ourselves out, probably through mass killings. Conversely, Steven Pinker, a Harvard professor, wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he says we're actually becoming less violent as time goes on. And Anne Frank famously said, in spite of everything, I still believe that people are good at heart. You all have witnessed human nature, or experienced it through your families, in its extremes. And I know this is a very, you know, sort of philosophical question. What is your view on human nature and humanity and a sense of hope? How do you maintain that sense of hope in light of what you've seen firsthand? Actually, this I'm going to start with Renee, if you don't mind, about what's your sense of human nature in light of all that you've experienced?
Well, I feel that you cannot judge humanity as a whole. I mean, you have to understand that, yes, there are people who are vicious, who are murderers, but there are, yes, I believe, like Anne Frank believed, that there are many good people. The problem is that these good people are scared. And that's what we have to understand. Being scared doesn't help any. So you have to learn to protect yourself as much as you can and help others if it's necessary, even though you may risk your own life. And this is what we have to learn.
I've gone through my teenage years, you know, when things were kind of hopeless or I was just confused and lost, and then the Freedom Riders happened, and then I had a sense of hope. And then I moved on and lived my life and maintained that sense of hope for a long time. And then you sink back in, you watch the news, and you watch these horrible movies, and you're reminded about just how horrible people can be, and then you lose this sense of hope. And you feel like people don't have any kind of humanity. And then you give up. It seems like it's just such a battle that you can't just fight on your own. And so for me, I went through that very angry phase of, why do I even care about people when they don't care about me or my family? It was such a huge battle that I fought for many years across all areas of my life. But when my dad passed, he passed away with a smile on his face. And in my culture, when somebody passes away like that, they have very good karma, and it doesn't happen to a lot of people. I learned that he had 3 children before me with another woman. And my mother had two children with a different family, and they all died during the war. All of them. And when they came together and they found hope and they started all over again, I was born in a refugee camp. And my sister was born and my brother. Growing up, I was so angry. I didn't understand why. There was such this huge, why did they shelter me so much? Why couldn't I have the freedom like everybody else? But I understood at that moment why. Because they can't lose another child to war. They can't let me walk out of that house and be shot down. What will he do if he lost another child? I understood why he was so hard on me. I understood everything at that moment. when I just thought he was a bad person, he was actually my hero. So my lesson in humanity came to me when my dad passed. I needed something to pull me in and to believe in people again, and my dad showed me that.
Thank you. Gary, did you want to say something?
Yeah, just to expand on that, thank you for being brave and really tell that story to all of us. Hope is everything. I remember my mama liked to tell stories. I can remember the night when I was leaving our village to escape to Ethiopia and walk about 250 miles by foot. And mama always tell me, say, Gare, whenever you walk in the long grass and you find a little small path, that path is not going to go in the middle of nowhere. It always wind up where there's another human being. So in a way, she was telling me, always never lose hope. But things was not making sense when I was small. And then the older that I get, and then I start to understand that she was trying to cultivate something in my head, which is hope. So I myself have a lot of hopes that we can really clean our world and we can live in peace. That is something that never died in me, and I'm always going to continue to go forward and continue to share and have another young person that we'll take on from there. And I think that's exactly what we all are doing here. And I'm very touched, and thank you so much.
Thank you. And Zlata, I want to give you the last word on this subject. I mean, you have been compared to Anne Frank in your diary, and I'm sure that that line about her still having a sense of people's goodness has struck you. But just to throw in a quick personal story, I had a chance to go to Sarajevo years ago, and my guide was a young Bosnian man whose entire family was killed by the Serbs. His father was shot dead by a Serb sniper. And I found out that he was engaged to a Serbian woman. And I said to him, how can you not be filled with hate? And he just said, at some point, it has to stop. It just has to stop. And I'm just wondering from your own experiences and your views on this subject of, do we focus on stories of reconciliation and hope, or in some way, do we have to really focus more on the horror of the situation?
I think we have to really get a full picture, we have to understand both. And I do, despite everything, equally still believe in the goodness of people. And sometimes when I'm remembering stories from, even personally, when I'm reflecting on the times during the war, I remember the incredible kindness and humanity that all of us shared, that if somebody got up, we had no food, we had no water, we had no electricity, someone would maybe get a parcel of food and they would share it. They wouldn't keep it for themselves. They would share it with all the neighbors, and they would give the medication to the older person, and they would give the powdered milk to the kids. And despite everything, I really, really believe that, and I am invigorated every day that I meet small and huge acts of kindness. And I think to see this room of people who are willing to keep spreading the message, a message of hope and peace, and to use stories of war and atrocities to spread that message. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive. They are complementing, but they're driving the same message that we can make a change, that we can be heroes in small ways and big ways. We can be a hero in a school corridor when someone's being bullied. We don't, these are all these things that are absolutely translatable also into everyday life. One of the things I just wanted to pick up on what Renee was talking about, hearing about the Armenian genocide, when I was growing up, I was hearing about the Holocaust, and we've all passed on this kind of very sad sort of stories from generation to generation. But what we do before we experience it, we think that wars happen to other people. For Renee, the genocide was happening to Armenians. It couldn't happen to her. To me, genocide was happening during the Second World War. There were wars happening in Africa when I was growing up. And we always think that these things happen to other people, but they don't. They happen to people like us. There are heroes just like us. There are horrible people equally just like us. We are all the same, and it's about driving a positive message of change and goodness whilst also accepting the sadness. But in my case, it's certainly, the glass is always more half full than half empty, and I really, really believe that we can make good in this world, and that we do make, and I do concentrate on that too.
I want to paraphrase Trezor, who was so positive and so hopeful. He always says, "We got this. We got this." What a way to end this. We got this. We're going to leave this ballroom and spread this message. Hope and love and humanity, changing our world one person, one class, one school at a time. In honor of their truth, may we never lose hope in humanity. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and our associate producer, Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we learn to love. May we have the courage to do what is right. And as our panelist Zlata Filipovic so passionately proclaimed, may we honor the memory of those who perished and the experiences of those who survived. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told. Hi, folks, it's Erin Gruwell. We hope you had a wonderful summer. As you know, we switched to a bi-weekly release schedule during our busy Summer Institute season. We couldn't be more grateful for how engaged you remained in our podcast. Our listeners continue to grow, and the feedback we receive about our extraordinary guests is both humbling and heartening. In order to preserve the production quality and creative content of each episode, we've decided to maintain this bi-weekly schedule. This will help us continue to serve you effectively as we carry out our educational programs at the Foundation. Thank you for listening to our show and for sharing it with others. We look forward to staying connected and helping you make a difference.